Good evening, everyone. My name is Ayça Çubukçu. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Sociology and the co-director of LSE Human Rights here at the London School of Economics and Political Science. Welcome to the LSE, if you're not here every day. It's a pleasure to have everyone here tonight to celebrate Professor Kostas Douzinas' new book. So on behalf of LSE Human Rights and Dr. Bernard Keenan, the co-organizer of this event from Birkbeck Law School, who unfortunately couldn't be with us due to an emergency, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the school and introduce our speakers tonight. Now, we have gathered in this lecture hall today to celebrate the publication of and to discuss the ambitions and implications of the most recent book, States of Exception, Human Rights, Biopolitics, and Utopia, by the exceptional scholar and activist and politician, Professor Kostas Douzinas. Now, considering the major crises Europe has faced over the last three decades, this book offers a multidisciplinary examination of the ways in which law, human rights, and politics have evolved and were affected by recent emergencies. In this book, Professor Douzinas assesses and critiques the ways in which governments have responded to three distinct emergencies: the 2008 economic crisis, the large flows of refugees and migrants since 2010s
onwards,
and the COVID-19 pandemic. Utilizing Foucault's theory of biopolitics and Professor Douzinas' experience as a critical scholar and politician, this insightful book reviews the law and politics of emergency. It seems like we're in a permanent state of emergency. I'm sure that will come up in the Q&A. And proposes pathways of resistance, which I would be in particular hurry to discuss. What are the pathways of resistance in this state of exception we're living? Ultimately, States of Exception asks to what extent critical legal theory can inform radical politics and argues that human rights are not the last utopia, pace pace, Samuel Moyn, watch out, but a combination of the unfulfilled promise of dignity with the desire to transcend inequality and exploitation. So I didn't do much creative work there. That's behind the book, which is here on sale for you to take a look and hopefully acquire. Now, before I introduce our speakers, a few practicalities. First, this event is a roundtable discussion about Professor Douzinas' book, which is available right here. And second, a warning, this event is being video and audio recorded. And unless we have technological contingencies, emergencies, and other practical difficulties, this will be up on LSE's website soon. Now, tonight we will begin the discussion with a brief 10 minutes, is that right? Introduction to the book by Professor, I'll come to your exception, Oscar. To the book by Professor Douzinas himself, who is, as many of you would know, a professor of law at Birkbeck University of London. Kostas is also the former director of the Birkbeck Institute for the Humanities. He has created two new interdisciplinary areas of research, we could say, a distinct school of British critical legal thought and the turning of legal scholarship towards ethical concerns and also aesthetic considerations, namely his research on law and visuality. Kostas's books have been translated into 13 languages and have led to extensive lecture tours across Latin America, South Africa, and his home continent, Europe. Kostas has been involved in the various movements of the 2010s and has written extensively for The Guardian, Open Democracy, and other global publications. So that's Kostas, everyone. Now, after Professor Duzinas, we will hear from Kirsten Campbell, who's sitting to my right, who's professor in sociology at Goldsmiths College. Her research investigates conflict-related sexual violence in international criminal law and transitional justice. Kirsten has worked on policy and practice in this area with NGOs, governments, and the United Nations. Her recent book, The Justice of Humans, Subject, Society, and Sexual Violence in International Criminal Justice, draws on her European Research Council projects, The Gender of Justice, and Transform. Thank you for being here, Kirsten. After Kirsten, we will then hear from Professor Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Oscar is the award-winning author of What If Latin America Ruled the World, published by Bloomsbury in 2010, and Story of a Death Foretold, Bloomsbury 2014, as well as Decolonizing Ethics, the Critical Theory of Enrique Dussel. He's one of the presenters and producers, you're also producing the podcast, right, Oscar, of Beyond Borders podcast. His fiction work, Under the World, the 87 Press, will be launched at the Hay Festival and Edinburgh Festival later this year. Oscar, as many of you would know, is professor of human rights and political philosophy at Birkbeck. Last but not least, we will hear from LEC's own legendary Conor Geerty, who is professor of human rights law at LEC Law School. Conor is also the former director of LEC Human Rights, formerly known as the Center for the Study of Human Rights, which he directed from 2002 to 2009. In 2012, Professor Geerty became the director of LSE's Institute of Public Affairs, and in this capacity was responsible for a crowdsourced UK constitution drafted in 2015. Conor has published widely on terrorism, civil liberties, and human rights. I must also mention he's an activist as well, if that is a term we would like to use. I think it will come up a lot. He's a barrister and was a founding member of Matrix Chambers, from where he continues to practice. As I mentioned, most of our roundtable speakers will speak for about 10 minutes, except for Oscar, who has claimed the sovereign exception for himself and who will speak for 17 minutes. Let's call it a poetic license, instead of the sovereign exception.
Channeling my Latin American dictator.
Okay, fine. All right. Once we hear from our speakers, I will turn to you all for your insightful questions, and we will have a collective discussion about the state of emergency that we're currently in. Now, without further ado, I turn to Professor Kostas Duzinas to welcome to the world States of Exception, Human Rights, Biopolitics, and Utopia.
Do I need this? Yep. Okay, thank you.
Actually.
I don't. Hello, one,
yeah,
two. Yeah,
works.
Lovely. Okay, thank you very much, Aicha. This group of people here is quite amazing. And as Aicha was speaking, I mean, my experience from book launches is that the author does not say much and usually speaks last. Now, I was asked to speak first. And, thinking about it right now, I think this change of order gives me the chance to make two preparatory comments. The first is that the gift, any gift, does not call for a counter gift. This is what our philosophical tradition tells us. The gift is not something to be reciprocated. It is not something to be returned. It is a sovereign act, and therefore the gift creates a bond, not the need to get a reward. It is not about gift and counter gift, but it is about the creation of a bond. It's an event, a bond between the donor and the donee. And I think the gift that my four good friends are going to make to me today present exactly the bond or reinforce an existing bond. Now, the second preparatory remark is this. Usually, and I expect this to happen from this group of critical and sarcastic commentators, to criticize the book. This is what we do. This is what critics and authors and academics do. And the usual answer of the person criticized, particularly in the academic world, not so much in the literary world, is to turn around and say, you did not understand what I was talking about. I was talking about something else. Go back, read the book again. I did not mean what you said. Now, personally, I think that I always thought that this is a totally wrong and actually pretty unacceptable answer. Why? Because when a book is published, it has broken anchor, it has sailed, it has entered the great ocean of words and texts, the ocean of language and of textuality. And once it has entered that ocean, then the reader, any reader, and the critic, any critic, even the most severe critic, have as right and as power to interpret the text as the author, with one exception. The one exception is, and there the author has authority, is to explain, if asked, the when, where, and how, in what circumstances, and feeling what feelings and emotions she wrote a particular book or a particular passage in that book. And of course, when you do that, of course, you have always to be quite alert to the mnemonic falsities, the ways in which the filtering of memory may actually distort the archive. But this is what I'm going to do now with two little vignettes which speak about emotions and about two instances in which this writing of the book started and then developed. First is February 2020. Mm-hmm. Around mid-February, we used to have every day the so-called masochism hour. That was the hour between 7 and 8 in the Channel 4 news. And of course, the Channel 4 news were all about the pandemic. And it was in that masochism hour that I heard the term herd immunity for the first time. It was spoken by people like Dominic Cummings, even Chief Whitty, Chris Whitty, the chief scientific advisor. And of course, Johnson kind of wrapped it all up when he said, it was this infamous statement, that some families will lose their loved ones before their time. And it was the first time that I had heard this term, herd immunity, in the context of a pandemic, in the context in which the herd was all of us, mm-hmm. the population. And it was that kind of dark, dreadful experience when we heard that, which gave me the first prompt to abandon the book that I had started writing and start writing a new book about what was happening in the pandemic. Because that idea of the herd immunity and its implementation is perhaps one of the best examples of what we call biopolitics. In other words, the operation of power over biological life, the targeting of populations, groups, and collectivities instead of individuals. herd immunity, as you remember, was the idea that you let the virus, the disease, spread in the population, infect large numbers of people, and eventually, at some point, you know, the whole population will become immune to the disease. The, of course, obvious effect being that all the vulnerable people might die. So that idea of herd immunity meant that for individuals, particularly vulnerable and older individuals, all idea of rights, of protections, of guarantees against the government were gone, were out of the way. So you had that kind of idea of immunity for health reasons, which at the same time was suspending the immunities and protections we have fought over many centuries to get against the government. I mean, Connor has written repeatedly about the history of civil rights in this country, and I think all of us have been involved in that kind of practice and writing. So the immunity for health was suspended and even destroying the immunity and the protections from government. And here you find a very interesting paradox in that in terms of our liberal constitution and our individualistic understanding of the world as it is being propagated, each one of us is unique, unrepeatable, incomparable. We're atomic existences, totally unique. And then at the same time, that kind of policy, the policy of herd immunity, the policy of biopolitics, means that while we're being told, we're being called upon to feel unique and brilliant and totally incomparable, makes us at the same time just specimens of a statistical group, makes us people who are totally similar with everyone else and whose individual and unique characteristics that have been so much celebrated by a neoliberal society in particular basically mean nothing. So that was my first kind sort of prompt towards working in that area. The second goes to, again, the masochism, but this was kind of funny. I mean, funny in a bitter, in a very embittered kind of way. Mr. Johnson again, in September now of 2020, made another infamous statement saying that we are a freedom-loving country. It is difficult to ask the British population uniformly to obey guidelines. And he said that in the context that when the second wave of the disease hit the country, it had become very clear that other countries like Italy, Germany, or France had fared much better than the Brits. And Johnson wanted to justify his position because we love freedom, because we do not obey, because we are individualistic, and so on. And of course, as I said, this was a kind sort of funny moment, a bitter kind sort of laughter we had in listening this view, because of course it was his government that was totally undermining any and every sense of freedom. And freedom became the big contested side of the period. It was already, I mean, the big dilemma of freedom against security, which Connor has written so much about, became from an abstract idea that people discuss in seminar rooms, something that was happening every day in our lives. And I think both these instances made me think that in emergencies, a number of hidden preconditions of life and thought, preconditions of normal times, come to the surface. In normal times, we kind of live through them, we don't talk about them, we forget them. They come to the surface and they allow us to analyze them and perhaps even to try and change them. And in that sense, the emergency is the best time to examine normality. So this is what we try to do with this book. And with freedom, of course, it was again very clear that it was politically contested, that governments were using freedom in order to align individual behavior with the prerogatives of a capitalist society. They were balancing so-called individual freedom and health against the interests of the market. And of course, freedom, on the other hand, was being used by people, both those who were protesting, and some of them were conspiracy theorists, some others were extreme right-wingers and so on. But there was again a global wave of protests around the world, which clearly showed that the trust of the people in government, which had been eroded in the previous emergencies, was now becoming really thin, and protest was and resistance was going to be the future of our societies. Final point. Over perhaps 25 years, I've written four books about human rights. I've written various other books, but four about human rights. The End of Human Rights and Temper, Critical Jurisprudence, and the Radical Philosophy of Rights. This is the last book, and that's why I started with a reference to Frank Mohn's wonderful book, The Sense of an Ending. And when we talk about human rights, I still today argue and support and defend two propositions that I first introduced back in 2000. I was attacked, you know, globally at the time. I think most books today, published today about human rights, most books would accept those two propositions. The first is this. The end, the purpose of human rights, is to resist public and private domination and oppression. If they lose that end and become the latest version of a civilizing mission, as we had in Iraq and various other places, then their usefulness comes to an end. That is the first one. Human rights, from my point of view, are about resistance, and they're being used around the world for that purpose, but of course governments are using them for different purposes. The second is this. We're being told, and this is what standard human rights courses teach, not Aisha or Connor or Oscar or Kirsten, that human rights belong to humans just because we're human. On account of our humanity, you know, we're born humans, and therefore we have those human rights because they grow on us like lambs. Now, this is not true. Humanity, the humanity of rights, introduces a claim to universality. That is true. But if you look at the political and legal history of human rights, you realize that human rights have been used throughout history in order to construct the human across a spectrum of the fully human, the lesser human, and the non-human. And Gaza is where we stand today. Because it seems to me that none of us can enter a human rights teaching room or act in the name of human rights without saying again and again and repeating that this never again, it has to be never again for everyone, everywhere. That without accepting today that the denial of past and present atrocities not only destroys the dignity that human rights supposedly have, but also totally undermines and destroys that desire called utopia, which is what makes all of us really hope in our lives. It seems to me that Gaza is the litmus test for the future of human rights, and I hope that this book, to a certain limited extent, contributes in that mission. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Okay, so can you hear me? Yes, great. So of course, Kostas is a very hard act to follow.
Yes.
So, forgive my rather serious engagement with your book, Kostas. And I indeed...
You accept all the criticism I said.
Well, I have many questions, as you will see. So, of course, I wanted to thank you for this invitation to engage with Kostas's important new work, States of Exception. In my view, the book offers a crucial diagnosis, indeed, of our troubled times, as you have been saying, Kostas. But rather than despairing at our current political realities, states of exception powerfully argues for possibilities of collective action in resistance, mm-hmm. political praxis, and utopian thought. It is salutary reading for anyone seeking to understand the role of law in contemporary social life, grapple with the challenge of imagining a society of justice and freedom, and engage in the actual practice of politics. So states of exception reminds us of the difficulty and necessity of both understanding our present and building alternative futures. Now, the starting points of the book, in those starting points, Kostas describes three components of an academic and political life, namely critical legal theory, human rights, and politics. And in this regard, Kostas's academic and political life, they clearly have not been separate, mm-hmm. have played a crucial role, and I particularly want to acknowledge this, in creating future paths for generations of critical and radical lawyers, myself included. So thank you, Kostas, for mm-hmm. opening these paths for us. And it is from the perspective of a critical legal theorist, a philosopher of human rights, and an accidental politician that states of exception takes up three questions. Has critical legal theory helped us to understand the way in which law operates during the term of a radical left government? A fabulous question that we have from the Russian Revolution onwards and before, of course. The second question is, do we live in a permanent state of exception? And the third is, does critical theory help move politics and law in a progressive direction? Now, Kostas modestly describes the book as offering some preparatory answers to these questions, but clearly these are not mere preparatory answers, mm-hmm. because they include a new critical legal theory of law and life in states of exception, his final thoughts, as he puts it, on the radical potential of human rights, although I doubt very much they are, in fact, your final thoughts, Kostas, and a crucial reflection of what it means as a critical lawyer to engage in political praxis. So I would like to only take up three important themes in this rich and thought-provoking book. I'm particularly interested in these themes because of my own work on the question of international justice for gender-based conflict crimes. However, I also think they raise more generally crucial questions for all those who seek to critically engage with law, human rights, and politics in the contemporary context of both the rise of deep reactionary forces mm-hmm. and the re-emergence of anti-systemic movements. So given this, I would very much like to hear your views on these questions, Kostas. So the first theme is the relationship between law and politics. On the nation-state level, as Aisha has outlined, and of course Kostas, states of exception argues it's Foucault and not Agamben mm-hmm. that we should turn to understand the current role of law in Western European states, and we might also discuss that focus. These states of exception, exemplified by austerity, the pandemic, and of course the so-called refugee crisis, reveal that law no longer mediates between citizen and state, as in liberal orders at least claim to do, but in fact have become part of the neoliberal regulation of groups and populations, as indeed Kostas was summarising there. And in the book he outlines, this includes the privatisation of public services, the legalisation of private life, and the replacement of legal rules by norms or regulations. In this same moment, Kostas also points to protest and resistance, and their emergence, and with it what he calls biopolitical rights. That is, rights and demands created through solidarity against power and recognition of the common good. So biopolitical rights, you argue, are tools for social mobilisation and not judicial tactics. They can be seen as the truest and most fundamental form of rights and as imminent to our refusal of power and our imagining of another world. So my question around this theme then concerns the role of worldly law, that is, law as it is and not as we would hope it would be, right? So given that law no longer carries its normative force and no longer restrains oppressive power, as you were describing, but instead carries power through the social body, then what are the implications of this for the work of a radical lawyer? Mm-hmm. What new forms of legal critique might be needed to engage with what you call neo-legalism? If law no longer carries its normative or even real force, then why engage with it? Can or should we try to give biopolitical rights material existence in legal rules and institutions? The second theme that I'd like to turn to is the relationship between law and war at the international level, as indeed you just referred to. In an important discussion of cosmopolitanism and just wars, you return to the critique of cosmopolitanism mm-hmm. as a form of secularized morality, which you argue has been a main contributor to the current disregard and degradation of international law. And in its place, you suggest another model of a not yet cosmopolitanism, one which can be built, you argue, in legal and institutional arrangements. And the example that you use in a very moving way is that of Greece and North Macedonia, which you describe as a cosmopolitanism of recognition. So my question concerns the role of international law in this model of not yet cosmopolitanism, both in terms of its classical role as the law of relation between states and in its role in the United Nations legal regime as a mechanism for the prevention of war and the restraint of waging of war. Do you think it matters that international law has been degraded and disregarded? Mm-hmm. If not, is it possible to imagine, use ad bellum or use in bello as part of this not yet cosmopolitanism? Or can they only ever be secularized morality masking real relations of violence? I have in mind here the strong critiques of international law currently emerging in Twail and Marxist mm-hmm. debates, which argue against engagement with international law as such on the grounds that is irretrievably an expression of global capitalism and great power interests. Should then we abandon international law and only engage in politics now? The third theme concerns the relationship between law and justice, focusing on your final thoughts, again, I question this, on the radical potential of human rights. There you point to true radicalizing forces within human rights. What you call radical natural law and rights, which emerge in protest, resistance, and revolution, and on the other, critical utopian thinking, which imagines the future just society. These two forces, you argue, structure human rights not as a realistic or last utopia, but indeed as the as yet unfulfilled promise of dignity and the not yet existing place of happiness. So my question concerns the making of this justice to come in our current historical juncture. Why do human rights remain an important place of radical thinking and politics? How does their current operation as a real, symbolic, and imaginary legal order shape our utopian desires? And finally, whether it is possible or even desirable to build other forms of law and justice from what the radical natural law and rights and critical utopian thinking currently emerging in the anti-systemic movements and ideas of our time. So I'm very much looking forward to your views.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was great. Because he's a friend, and the best way to express love for one's friends is to embarrass them, I'm going to tell you a story that proves Costas is legendary. Mm-hmm. Legend has it that before Costas entered the territory controlled by the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia during a visit to Latin America in the early 2000s, his partner told him, if you are retained by the FARC, make yourself useful. In other words, put your body where your revolutionary mouth is. This, I believe, is his response to the only question that matters nowadays, as we just heard. Is there any place for hope in the wake of lost and last utopias? In what follows, I am going to stress test, as we international lawyers do, the argument that Ducinas's critical life work, and in particular this book, can be best read and interpreted as a fruitful response to this pressing question. In doing so, he has helped to better our understanding of the history and philosophy of human rights. Not only that, he also enlarges the horizon of our political imagination and grounds the attainability of such new visions in the dynamicity and vulnerability of matter, the corporeality of the ethical agent riveted to time and history. In short, he has made us better. It all began in Colombia. Imagine Professor Ducinas engaging in deep political and philosophical discussion with the South American rebels. What would be the subject? The likelihood of revolution, or perhaps the complicity between a conception of human rights advanced by interventionist governments in the West and their commitment to protect the interests of economic actors abroad, which turned them, as he argues, into the perfect companion of neoliberalism. Phrase that has awakened and has aroused plenty of criticism. No matter how controversial they might seem to today's culture warriors and mainstream academics, questions of non-reformist reform revolution and the relationship between the pessimist outlook of certain tenets of liberal left theoretical practice and the rise of neoliberalism, neoconservatism, and neocolonialism are more relevant nowadays than they were back then when we visited Colombia. Hence my starting point to take a stock of Costas's life work in general and the book we celebrate today in particular. A question. Since we no longer have faith in the story that a geopolitics of progress could serve as a guarantee or a blueprint towards equality and freedom, are we fated to live between the purgatory of complacency and hellish dystopia? That question resonates with another question posited by Ernst Bloch, the German critical theorist, who becomes the protagonist of the second part of the book, which is my favorite part of the book. Formidable challenge to the filling of contemporary history and philosophy, which Ducinas takes up with determinate focus in the second part of his book. Bloch said, "We owe to the grand writer of expressionism, Arthur Schopenhauer, an exceptionally powerful image of the world, which shows at the same time his vital aboulia and angry outlook resulting in a denunciation of life. Schopenhauer tells us that if we consider it from a moral point of view, the world looks like a den of evil thoughts, and if we consider its intellectual orientation, like a madhouse." For Bloch, after Auschwitz and Majdanek, our moral image of the world has taken on board Schopenhauer's pessimism to describe the old problem of evil. Whereas the old problem of evil pointed to the inconstancy of human will in certain torrid climates as its first cause, thereby opposing willpower to the tendencies of nature and reducing the latter to an inert, fact-based objectivity ruled by immutable laws, the new problem of evil, Neue in Bloch's parlance, marks the persistence of metaphysical and voluntaristic forms of thinking after Enlightenment science ought to have debunked them. Mm-hmm. It does this by positing a cognitive apparatus affixed to individual identity or a viewpoint that calls us to act as if we still believed in liberty or liberties that belong to the same constellation as immortality and God. The implication being that the materials of this world are not fit to give birth to truly new social forms of temporal alterity, or novum in Bloch's parlance, again, without the aid of some kind of godlike agency, even if it is only the lesser form-giving power of a deus ex machina. So in a world without, as Bloch puts it, interweaving process connections between past, present, and future, there is no room for real possibility. Such would be a hopeless world, unable to envision the growth of the genuinely new. Such a hopeless world could only be described realistically via the conventions and perspective of melodrama. But the pull of such conventional perspective and narrative is, to simply put it, reactionary. For Bloch, this problematic compromise between morality and coupled from religion and melodramatic theater becomes apparent when mainstream modern philosophy and social theory proclaim their realism unaware that its presuppositions only make sense within the trajectory of persisting metaphysical voluntarism and philosophical pessimism exemplified by Schopenhauer. Bloch says, the bloody abyss of Auschwitz, that's what he means, presupposes a new contribution to Schopenhauer's theory. It connects the dreadful myths of Hades with his reading of Dante's Divine Comedy. Where could Dante take the matter to build his hell if not out of our real world? This way he gave form to true hell. But when asked to describe heaven and its joys, he was confronted by an unsurmountable difficulty simply because the actual world offers no material to orient such task. That's Bloch. Notice how in the passage Bloch quotes from Schopenhauer's moral image of the world, the key terms come from a singular physics and metaphysics. To be precise, what Bloch specified as right-wing Aristotelianism, when he tried to connect the call for thorough change with the static demands of law and rights in Avicenna on the Aristotelische Linke, and crucially for our take on Costas's recent book, Naturrecht und menschliche Würde, whose English version Costas, colleague Kojo Koram and I, have been using for years in our postgraduate course on the philosophy of history and human rights at Birkbeck. As you know, in the right Aristotelian scheme, matter is inert matter, void of dynamicity or time-bound volatility, whereas form is imperative, categorical, and substantial, or normalizing, what James Martel felicitously calls archism. In the right Aristotelian formulation, now understood along the lines of modern extensionalist logic, actuality is the temporality of a world seen as machina mundi, subject to the instrumentalist energeia of global trade and excess value, and in which the call to action is directed in accordance with the orientation of the post-Kantian formulation of the as-if. Potentiality becomes in this scheme the structuring or normalizing drive figured in the analogy with the steerman, leading otherwise inert matter to finality or final rest in its proper place. In accordance with the modern rendition of this schema, even though we know there are no longer firmer grounds to believe in mechanical laws or the causal power of evil, nevertheless, we are called upon to continue acting as if we believe in such things, as Mark Fisher reminded all of us. On the one hand, this is demonstrated by the strong compulsion of a call-out public culture on both the liberal and conservative poles of the political spectrum to blame systemic tendencies or historical injustices such as racism, anti-Semitism, patriarchy, or the appropriation of excess value on the villainous proclivities of a constantly revolving cast of evildoers. That is precisely the kind of publicity and public culture that would have come to prominence with the rise of the human rights profession and of its vernacular to a position of respectability among institutions of international affairs and policy that Samuel Moyne, among others, locate correctly sometime in the 1970s and 80s as coinciding with the broader enthusiasm for a small state, individual liberties, and the decisionism advocated by people like Carl Schmitt, Friedrich Hayek, or Clinton Rossiter as the basis for a realist practice in constitutional and international public law and politics. This kind of publicity calls upon us to envision collective agency on the model of individual agency and mastery. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, this strong compulsion shows up in academic practice, especially in the social sciences, which insist that the only proper comparative study is that between alternative origins or comparative points already existing or within the realm of what is considered possible. Mm-hmm. They tend to present themselves as in public as realist, empirical, or as non-ideal theory in opposition to ideal theory. Non-ideal theories of this kind, because not all non-ideal theories refer to the same nature or are of the same nature, so non-ideal theories of this kind see themselves using quantitative and qualitative data to make their comparisons and arriving at descriptive or purportedly firmer evaluative conclusions on that basis alone. Further, they relate the distinction, their distinction between non-ideal and ideal theory to theories that distinguish between the optimum approach and the maximum approach to justice. Mm-hmm. Consider, for example, the work of Harvard scholar of human rights policy, Catherine Sinking. We can safely describe her work in this area as liberal, progressive, yet tempered and moderate, in the American sense of that term. Sinking herself defines her approach to progress in human rights history as non-ideal, a non-ideal approach, precisely in terms of the possibilist account of hope, bias, and progress that informed the work of German economist Albert O. Hirschman on developmentalist economic policy paradigms designed in the USA for Latin America, and also in the area of international relations. That is, to quote Sinking, the best alternative compared to other existing alternatives within the realm of the possible, as opposed to the maximum ideal of justice. According to Sinking, empirical comparisons are connected to the optimum approach to the field of human rights and within the realm of the possible. She adapts this approach to the field of human rights to argue for an optimum goal for human rights policy consistent with possibilism. This means conceptualizing movement toward progress along the lines of and within a frame of visuality that she calls a compliance continuum for human rights. According to her, by means of such graphs, we can empirically measure and detect, quoting her, both progress and retrogression in a way that ideal theory cannot. Possibilism informs, in turn, Sinking's more generic attack on human rights critical scholars like Ducinas and Moyne. She sees them as negative critics engaged in purely ideal theorization related to maximalist theories of justice and accuses them of engaging in comparison to an ideal that often remains implicit and or combining such implicit idealist comparison with hidden causal statements about human rights policies somehow leading to or making possible neoliberal economics. Ducinas's states of exception helps us debate moderate critics like Sinking and others in their own terrain and on their own terms. That is, from the standpoint of post-developmentalist perspectives on law and political economy developed in the Americas, especially in countries like Colombia, Brazil, and Argentina, that would culminate in the so-called decolonial turn in philosophy and the social sciences in alliance with critical theory approaches to hope, such as Bloch's, that sharply contrast with the possibilism of Hirschman. From such a standpoint, the problem concerns the unexamined metaphysical assumptions of self-styled realist or non-ideal approaches and possibilism. In a nutshell, instead of being realist, they maintain a reduced and reductionist conception of reality that leaves no room for the unfinished nature of matter, the incompleteness of knowledge or of events in time, and the unfinished materiality or reality of time itself, including the possibility of thorough material and historical unprecedented transformation. put in a way that may sound as more secular to the audience, non-ideal theories of this kind visualize history and nature in terms of a timeless space configuration, or at best, a block of spatial integrated picture in which what is real is only the entire history of the world, from past to present, taken as one and figured in stages of development of various typical groups, nations, or countries. Think of the kind of integral picture you find in typical anthropological or archaeological museums like the British Museum or the Gold Museum of Bogota. In this picture, time tends to be treated as a dimension of and reducible to space. As it happens, for example, when the proposed method is deemed empirical in that it calls upon us to compare what is possible in terms of contrasting what is actually happening to what has happened in the same place in the past or to what is happening in other countries or places at the same time. Here, as you can see, motion is frozen, as in a still photograph, by graphing records of past observations or precedents. Sicking's compliance continuum of types of human rights violations, for instance, is precisely that, a continuum. A graphing visuality measuring progress or retrogression along a line that makes depth and proximity apparent and calling observers to take such measurements and appearances as if they were temporal patterns. In fact, this kind of imaginal figuration suggests already that the empirical here is not as far from the operation of aesthetic ideals or orientations mm-hmm. as the empiricist theorist would like us to believe. But even then, the powers of judgment, imagination, projective thinking, and possibility are severely constrained by the freezing of motion in a model image of the world parallel to the timeless configuration space of classical mechanics or the block space picture of a space-time. Let us then speak of these approaches as approaches in which time is not real. They are non-naturalist in the temporal sense, which is perhaps why their ideal, non-ideal, as well as optimum, maximum, basic distinctions map so well onto positive conceptions of legality, developmental economics, and positivist social science. They all seem to labor under a common fallacy, the assumption that visualizing or narrating the state of a socio-historical system from its initial conditions or its more and less diverse, but in any case singular origins, makes it predictable as a type, not a bomb, to paraphrase Bruno Latour, paraphrasing Brazilian anthropologist Eduardo Viveiros de Castro. And that such paradigmatic assumption can be extended to make a theory or philosophy of history or the universe. For me, following Bloch, this is the result of the persistence of what they would call the physics and metaphysics of right Aristotelianism in contemporary philosophy, history, and social science, including the possibilism that social scientists like Sicking adapt to the field of human rights. To conclude, I believe Ducinas would agree with such diagnostic, especially given the turn of his most recent work on the philosophy and history of human rights towards hope and utopia in the explicit, determinate sense of Bloch's history, critical theory, and naturalism. This turn is most apparent in the chapter Human Rights in History, in the second part of States of Exception. He can now respond to the criticisms lodged by the likes of Catherine Sicking, Philip Alston, and other minor liberal critics by pointing out that, A, he, Costas, moves across case by case or empirical comparison and beyond towards comparison between what is lacking in what just is and fullness to come or not yet to avoid collapsing justice into what just is. He does so by making explicit non-capitalist and anarchist ideals in the precise terms of aesthetic normative ideas such as the hope principle applied to the doctrine of precedent that is familiar to the operation of judges in common law and human rights or constitutional jurisdictions. And B, this move invites us to rethink the structure of political thought itself, to revise our most basic presuppositions about what counts as evidence and causality in time, To go beyond teleology, univocity, and graphs or stories of origin, if we want to reinsert the unprecedented, determinate chance, and elements of irreversibility or the reality of time in our histories and ontologies to wed the demands of law and rights to the agenda of social revolution. We must do so, among other reasons, because if we only consider what is possible in terms of the present state of the world, that is, the states of exception of the title, we can only see hell, as Schopenhauer did, or at best, evidence of progress or retrogression within a timeless or block universe configuration of a space-time that leaves no room for true novelty. But that would be the equivalent of a theory telling us that our efforts in the past-present to realize grander or maximal designs of historical justice, our protests and activism in the present future are fated to fail or remain inconsequential. In such a world, justice is not an option. The result of such a theory is the eternal look at pessimum that predominates among contemporary philosophers and so-called public intellectuals writing in the popular media, which is also the opposite of what liberal progressives like Sicking tell us they desire. Crucially, however, if the future is genuinely open, at least in the sense that when there are no precedents, there will be no prediction for how a system will behave or respond to measurement, then no such pessimistic theory is possible. Here and now, justice becomes an option. I believe this is the real input of the Cynicist's life work and this book in particular. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Connor, do you need a microphone?
Yeah, I'm going to use that one, actually.
This one? Yeah.
I'm going to stand up, if I may. Is that okay? Where's this camera? There's nobody watching anyway. Is there? It's broken. Usually broken.
There is one.
Usually broken. Hello.
I thought only ours. I thought only ours were always.
No.
Yes.
LSE solidarity. We want to make you feel at home, Oscar. We've got a problem, folks. We've got a problem. I'm standing up because I didn't want to blank all of you. I didn't know there were that many of you over there. Fantastic. The problem is I have, he had fessed up to 17 minutes. I mean, mine is, you know, fairly schematic. So we need to keep an eye on the time, Chair.
Yes, I am.
We need to keep an eye on the time. We haven't started yet, but when we start, when we start, I have 10 minutes.
Yes.
I have 10 minutes.
You've done this
before. I have not started yet. I've not started yet.
I know this.
This is called a preliminary bonding with the audience. I've got 3 minutes on him over there. It may go under. There isn't a lot to say. I've got 3 minutes on power, and I have 3 minutes on pathways to resistance or off resistance. And that takes us to 9, because I haven't started yet. And then there'll be a bit of extra bits, and we come in at 10. And in the event of my still talking about Costas after 10, actually, you'll tell me to stop, won't you?
I will.
You'll tell me to stop a bit more abruptly than you gently tried to wind down Oscar.
I will stop.
4 hours into his Castro simulation. And I'm not talking about the old brother, I'm talking about the real one. Now, look, first of all, 3 minutes on Costas. You got a sense of the thrill of Costas Dezinas when he summed up at the end. You got a sense of the thrill. Let me tell you what it's like to get that thrill when you've grown up in a more orthodox legal environment. When something tells you there's something wrong about the rubbish you're teaching, about the wonders of a bloke from Oxford called Dicey, about the absolute superiority of the English system of law and civil liberties, about the perfection of human rights when, I'm from Ireland, Irish people are being jailed for no reason, when the police are beating up protesters, when all around you is a contradiction of what you're asked to discuss. Costas Dezinas is a fundamentally important person in my intellectual life because he rescued me from the contradictions of seeking to reconcile the irreconcilable. And so what his work has done for me,
has been to educate me, to understand, to be able to question the liberal engagement that I still claim to have. So what I am, I've just got another book out on terrorism. I read the theorists, and I don't mention them. So my intellectual position is not to talk about them, but to know them. And it's because of him. Because of him. Now, he named a whole lot of books. I thought ominously, are we nearly at 3 minutes yet? Ominously, he left out the two he co-edited with me. He left them out. Now, I thought this giant, magnificent whale of a man would never deliver a single chapter on time. And the whole thing was going to be impossible because he emerges out of the sea for a day and you feel like he's an intellectual Aslan. And then he goes away again. He runs some country, or I think I wasn't quite clear, he's kidnapped by FARC and ends up running FARC. And their statement certainly improved greatly after his apprehension. I remember that. And then he comes back again. So it's a bit frustrating, but we co-edited two books together. And we did a very memorable video, which we have tried to suppress. But he is, it's worth saying this, he is the most punctilious, careful, efficient person with whom I've written. I've written with quite a few. He's fantastic at that. So behind the veneer of the grand giant of a man is a very hardworking, hard-reading scholar with the gift of articulation. That's the end. Is that enough for you, Costas? He's dying, I think, because he announced about 4 times that this is his last book and everything. I think he's trying to curry favor. I think you're absolutely right, Kirsten, that it's just a showy effort. He'll be writing and writing, and good luck to him, and we need him. Power. 2 things he said today. I'm on minute 4. 2 things he said today about human rights. We see this as the construction of the human, and we need to understand its construction. It's not born. I still believe, obviously, with Aquinas and Augustine, that, you know, it's a Christian thing. But I know it's constructed. I know it's constructed. My faith has been in good order recently because of Gaza, on which more in a moment. But I know it's constructed. I didn't know it was constructed when I started. But it's constructed. That was a thing. Now, what does that mean? It means that through time, we have had the following tension. There's a construction of the human through the language of human rights, but the price of construction are some crumbs from the table of human rights for humanity. So we have Hobbes, who explains Leviathan, but in order to do so, to explain why there should be endless power, he says we have natural rights. We have Locke, who says men with property should be able to run the place. But if men with property should be able to run the place, why not others? We have consistently, when we commit to the construction of the human as part of our management of power, we have to concede something. And what do we concede? With the Americans after the Second World War, we create this notion of a universal human rights and so on. And they leave out, by the way, in all of this, the colonies completely. And I've done a new piece on Israel and the Council of Europe. It's fascinating how much they are left out. But what are the crumbs from the table of the exercise of power? They are the hostages to fortune. Our universality, which Costas talked about, and Kristen was very interesting on that, and equality. But I would also add law. I would also add law. So you can't plausibly talk about human rights without at least notionally claiming equality before the law, and without at least notionally claiming universality. It's the price you have to pay for constructing this kind of human, the one in which you enjoy all the advantages. And so I'm on to the third part. I'm showing an astonishing discipline. Pathways of resistance. This is one of the things I hope we can focus on, actually, mm-hmm. in the discussion. What to do? Mm-hmm. What to do? Are we going to be optimistic? Are we going to give up? You know, I was very interested in the remarks made about law. I'd like to discuss those. Mm-hmm. because what are the pathways to resistance? And then I have to say, I was extremely pleased that Costas mentioned Gaza at the end, because I have been, since the 7th of October, I have participated in many events, and I have often been the only person who's brought up Gaza. Last night I did the same. There is a desperate desire on the part of our world to pretend it's not happening, because it's too destabilizing for us to contemplate what is happening. And we therefore want to keep the show on the road, the human rights show. We're ordinary humans. We have our thing, which is universality and so on. And we don't want to be forced to question too much. But it is the show. It is the thing. It is being played out in real time. And what is the it? We know what the it is. We know it's the horrific destruction of a culture and of a people within a culture with disproportionate numbers of women and children. We know that. But what about the resistance? Because the crumbs from the table of power have caused people to believe that this is utterly and completely unacceptable. And that is, as it were, the price power has paid by whittling on about universality of esteem, when they didn't really mean it, but people took them at face value. And in a world of surprises, in a world of surprises, how much money would you have made if you took out a bet on Ivy League American students being in the van of a revolutionary moment in our culture? It's extraordinary. I can't explain it. Mm-hmm. I can't explain it. Except I will say this. The division exposed by Gaza, I thought for a while and used to say for a bit it was global north v. global south. It's not. Mm-hmm. It's power versus people. And the people can be across a variety of income brackets and a variety of opportunities. These people remind me a bit, multiplied by 100, of the wonderful groups that camped around St. Paul's in their effort to try and get us to rethink inequality. These people are taking enormous risks. You know that all these Trump judges have said they'll never take a clerk from the universities, from Columbia again. These people are being berated by the funders who run American universities, and they stick at it. These people are being beaten up by the New York police. And I mention them because they are extraordinary, but there's many like them. There's not many powerful people like them. A shout out for the Republic of Ireland. And what's the Republic of Ireland? It's the only global north country that was colonized. Now, the British have worked out that it wasn't because it was part of England and so on. Rubbish. They know what it's like. There was a famine in Ireland in the 19th century. They know what it's like to have an induced famine. And so, with the exception of one or two countries, Spain and Belgium continued to fund UNRWA, and the Israelis bombed their mission in Gaza a day after they'd said they'd continue to do it. So we have got hope, because there is an impossibility of the resistance of this over time, and it's huge, and it should get bigger. I'm a strong advocate, controversial point to throw out, of the boycott program, and I have got many, many strong Jewish supporters who are also from academia, who are supporters of the academic boycott. This needs not to be forgotten. If there's some kind of truce, and then we celebrate the Americans for their peacemaking power, then we will have lost. And if we lose on this one, what chances are there of ordinary, irregular migration people into the country not being shot? Because if you can do this with impunity, you can do anything with impunity. Very last point. The other crumb from the table is law. And this is the other point I think we should discuss. It was very interesting what you were saying about law. And the two of you actually dealt with law in different ways. Does it matter that the International Criminal Court has engaged as it did? Now, I'm party pre that the woman from Ireland, Bliana Ní Gualaí, who did the case, a close friend of mine. I'm a tremendous admirer of her. And I also have been an admirer for 40 years of John Dugard. And also, I know Vaughan Lowe. And I found the theater of the International Criminal Court compelling, independent of any outcomes. Facts matter in law. It's amazing. In our world of post-fact reality, where power determines what facts are, the last remaining people almost are the old lawyers. Old boring lawyers listen carefully. And we have got this possibility of the International Criminal Court issuing warrants. You know, the Americans have said they haven't got jurisdiction. The Americans, who refuse to belong to it, are now experts in international criminal law and can intervene like that. Of course, they mean it's for little people. They mean it's not for them. And they're now threatening the ICC with this and that. It's worrying to me there haven't been any warrants, but we need to stick by it. I believe, contrary to some of the guys you were talking about, I believe that law has a chance to do some good universalizing work in this arena, and I'll stop there. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me please begin where Connor ended and raise the specter of the International Court of Justice, ICC, on the one hand, to understand the implications of the book, to discuss the implications of the book for our current conjuncture. So we have the ICC and the ICJ on the one hand. On the other hand, we have about 165 campuses across the world being occupied, where encampments have taken place. So on the one hand, let's say the legal option. On the other hand, the resistance non-legal option. I don't want to schematize them as two separate things. Arguably, South Africa's case at the ICJ may have contributed to the politicization and the language that the movement in solidarity with Palestine has been using. But just to open up to discussion the implications of what you're proposing in this book, Kostas, how would you read the current moment from the perspective of the type of political, legal, and philosophical critique you're advancing in this book?
Yes, a difficult one. But let me start with a story about Connor, because he said the story about me. Back in the 2010s, when both Ireland and Greece were members of the PIGS, the countries that the European Union had imposed, you know, those reform programs, and the political system had almost collapsed, both in Ireland and in Greece. I was trying to persuade Connor to run for president of Ireland. And I was telling him that I would be his campaign agent, you know, because I knew all the old stuff, the old sort of leftist stuff. Eventually, he decided not to do it, although, he toyed with the idea a little. And as a result, I became a member of parliament. And of course, look what good it did to me. But I think it is important. You saw him, what a wonderful speaker he is, you know, how he can seduce an audience. That's been doing, you know, sort of all his life. And I think he would have been, you know, a wonderful speaker. Now, the other thing about Connor I wanted to say is that when we first met and, you know, we did those two books together, I was much more critical of law. I mean, those were the days in which, you know, we were more radical and, you know, I really felt coming from the critical legal studies movement, particularly at the point of defeat, we were defeated at all levels, not just in terms of scholarship and epistemology and so on, but also politically. And therefore, when you get defeated, you become a little, you know, you go to the extreme. And, you know, we were hugely critical of law. And I think talking to Connor and other colleagues, but Connor in particular, who was always developing this trickle-down theory of human rights, the crumbs from the table, you know, I'll call it that, the trickle-down theory. But he also explained, you know, sort of the importance of law as a defense, as protection, you know, sort of for the poor and the persecuted of this world. And of course, when then I became a politician and I had to leave this stuff, I mean, you know, as a critical lawyer or as a lawyer, you know, so you're always outside, you know, kind of sort of trying to work out what, you know, the lawmakers, parliament, governments, and the law interpreters, judges are trying to do. And there I was a lawmaker. So, I mean, you know, in that moment, I realized as a lawmaker and as someone who planned and prepared a major series of constitutional amendments, you know, to the Greek constitution. They failed at the end because the left lost. However, I realized how important it was to strengthen some of these legal guarantees. Now, turning very fast to the question of international law, and I'm sure many people here, you know, sort of will know more about this and have better views about it. Maria, looking at Maria here, a major international lawyer, and I'm sure others in the audience. Listen, back in 2003, just before the invasion of Iraq, as you remember, as you perhaps some of you remember, the older amongst ourselves, the elderly, the law became a major issue, the way that it is not here. Why? Because then Tony Blair, for his own purposes, in order to acquire legitimacy for the pending invasion, which he had decided, said publicly that I need legal recognition, legal acknowledgement that this invasion of Iraq is lawful. And lawful in the context of the Security Council of the United Nations, obviously not given an authorization. And I remember in those days, a bunch of international lawyers, some from the LSE, some others, you know, well-known names.
The teachers
of international law, wrote this letter to the people, the populace, you know, the government, saying that what was about to happen was illegal by any measure you wanted to take into consideration. Absolutely any measure. Of course, the government did not pay the slightest attention. But there was also another incident which is not generally known, and which is that the leader, the American leader of that movement of pragmatic legal studies from Harvard, a guy from Harvard, someone who had been the teacher of very many of my colleagues, reprimanded the people who wrote that letter to the government, telling them that it is unlawful what you're doing, saying this: we have taught all these years and we have developed a school of thinking which says that there is no right answers in international law. How dare you? How can you go back into the seminar room and explain that position, that there are no right answers, if you were prepared to publish a statement in the newspaper saying that it is unlawful? And it was at that point that I intervened in that debate against the American lawyer, not because I had become fully convinced and persuaded about the ability of law to stop the invasion, which it didn't at the end, but because I felt that when the lives of millions was at stake, and as we know, really lots of people, you know, hundreds of thousands lost their lives and whole countries were devastated as a result of the invasion, you have to use all means at your disposal either to stop this from happening or to ameliorate the situation. And therefore, writing a letter using your legal expertise in public in order to do it, you know, sort of, it is absolutely important and essential you have to do it. And here I say one last word, in a sense answering now to one of the many and interesting questions that, you know, we will need lots of wine and perhaps cigarettes and so on to respond to, cursing and so on. What is the role of the radical lawyer? And I think many of us have felt that difficulty. What it means to teach the law, and one hopes to teach it at the best of her ability, you know, because our students want to qualify, to become solicitors, barristers, and the rest of it, and at the same time to be radical. And my answer to this is that perhaps a radical lawyer, almost by definition, is not the right term, almost automatically, almost by becoming radical as a lawyer, is to a certain extent schizophrenic. There's a schizophrenia that we live in, and certainly I've lived speaking about myself. And what is the schizophrenia? That there are instances like the one that I mentioned in terms of international law in 2003, today with the ICC, the ICJ, and so on, where you as the lawyer have to be inside the court, in other words, to speak the law, and to keep telling those people who decide the law, listen, you cannot do this or that, because it goes against that legal archive that you have adopted or you have served up until now, and now you are breaking it. And that is what I would call an immanent critique, a critique that comes from within you know, the resources and, you know, the abilities that the legal system gives to you. At the same time, there are many other occasions, including perhaps even this one, in which you have to stand outside the court, outside the legal system, and shout at those inside the system, your system sucks. Your system is corrupt. Your system never delivers what it's supposed to be saying. And because of that, we need to look at another justice, and this takes me to Oscar. Because this other justice, I mean, Oscar mentioned about a number of non-idealist and non-ideal instances which somehow litter, and some, of course, glory our tradition. But we need that ideal. If we don't have an ideal to which we can turn to say this is wrong, then clearly we don't have any kind of normative foundation of what we're saying. Mm-hmm. But to the extent that all these ideals, to a certain extent, including the secular ones, have been undermined, have many of them left the political and the social and the cultural scene, we have perhaps, you know, sort of to reconsider them, to reconsider our tradition, to reconsider, for example, natural law. What I'm doing in this book, and I have already come under criticism, is to try and think again about natural law. But we have to think about natural law or about social utopia as something which happens in our secular immanence. It is a transcendence, but it is in our immanence. It is historical. It is no longer a reference to God or to some, you know, sort of pervasive sense of logos, reason, and so on and so forth. So we have to be in law, and we're entitled to be in law to the extent that we're always, and at the same time, stand outside of law and saying what is happening here is totally wrong.
I will take a question. On the one hand, it sounds like you're asking us to apply the law while breaking the law at the same time, based on a notion of justice that transcends the law. I still didn't get an answer to my question, but I...
Which was the question? What
about
did ICJ?
Gaza encampments on the one hand and ICJ on the other hand. But I will let others ask the questions. Yes, please.